Welcome to the next episode of Flintco Talks. It's your boy Dano. I am in St. Louis today, and I am happy to have Mr. Greg Kozik in the chair with us today. Greg is the chairman of the board of the Alberisi Corporation. Greg, welcome. How are you this morning?
Good, thanks, and good to see you, Dan.
Yeah, good to see you too. I really appreciate you coming in today. Those that are listening, I want you to pay attention today because Greg's probably going to give us some nuggets on what it's like to work for a big corporation like Alberisi, what it's like to see good leadership. And he's probably going to tell us some really some great stories today, a little history about the wonderful enterprise that a lot of us work for. So, Greg, to get started, we really want to get to know you a little bit better. So if you could tell us maybe a little bit about kind of your upbringing, things you did for fun, and kind of get us to the point where you came to Alberisi in the early 2000s.
You know, when you grow up with five brothers, so six boys.
Oh, wow.
Born in 59, 60, 61, 62, 65, and then sometimes they call it the afterthought, you know, 69. And there's always a lot of fun growing up. But we also grew up, you know, with a family with fairly modest means. My dad worked in a mine up in northern Ontario. Ironically, about 3 hours by train from the Sioux, where we currently have the Sioux Locks program. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, there wasn't a road from the iron ore mine. The iron ore was used at steel that was made Sault Ste. Marie.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd take there wasn't a road, so we'd take a train every August.
Wow.
To get running shoes, PF flyers, and blue jeans to start to start the school year.
Oh my goodness.
And eventually the family, you know, sort of in mining communities, they fall on hard times. Eventually the family moved to Southern Ontario, to Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad took a job at the Ford Oakville assembly plant. Growing up, I worked there, you know, and became old enough. I worked on the assembly line, those sorts of things. It was kind of ironic, you know, when you think about Alberisi's work, to go back and visit those plants and see us build them and that sort of thing. Settled into Hamilton. All the boys were big sports fans and sports players. We had to have jobs to afford. So that's why I had, you know, to play ice hockey, you know, where you had to have skates and hockey sticks and those sorts of things.
Oh, yeah.
I had a morning paper route, and I had a paper route in the afternoon. I folded boxes at a pizza parlor at a penny a box to make money. Both my mom and dad said, you know, we'd love to be able to support all of you in what you do, but we just don't have the means to do that. So if you can, you know, be self-sufficient, we'll do everything we can to drive you to the rink or drive you to the basketball court, to the gym. You know, in case of my brother Peter,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was a tremendous rower, rode for Canada at the World Championships, and you know, he bought a bicycle to ride, oh my goodness, winter blizzards to, you know, to ride to the rowing club, to get to rowing practice. So we all sort of grew up, you know, in that sense, having to be fairly self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
But anytime we wanted a basketball game or a street hockey game, it was self-made, you know, you three against us three.
Uh-huh. Just an old schoolyard pick 'em, right?
Absolutely.
Nice. I didn't realize that there was five brothers. I can only imagine what the house was like, or the train rides to get school clothes and all that kind of stuff.
It may be a bit of a zoo, honestly. and growing up in the, you know, really in the woods like that, we were, I don't know, wild's probably the wrong word, but I just remember, you know, being off in the woods playing fort and, you know, those sorts of things and capturing people and, And then all the moms, you know, keep going out on the back deck and yelling into the woods that it was lunchtime or dinner time.
Come home if you want to eat.
there was always the example where the phone would then start ringing, you know, where's Johnny? Is Johnny with you? And all the moms would start calling, and then we'd say, oh, shoot, we left Johnny tied to the tree. We captured him. He was tied to the tree. And we'd all start to remember. No one would want to admit to it.
Yeah.
And then have to go back in the forest and get him. Of course, you know, the mosquitoes, the black flies.
Oh, my goodness.
And then we'd all get scolded.
That's a great story. But I feel like learning that self-sufficiency at a young age, like folding pizza boxes for a penny a box, like that probably taught you something, some appreciation for work, right?
Appreciation for work and probably a recognition that, you know, maybe if I stuck at school or worked a little harder at school, I wouldn't have to do this, you know, into my 60s.
Uh-huh. Be a lot of pizza boxes by now, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's funny. I used to, when I'd have interns, the first day I would make them sweep the job site. And yep. At the end of the day, I'd ask them, like, what did you learn? And they'd say, I'm going to stay in college. I think I'm going to go and finish my degree so I don't have to start at the bottom of the... But why those folks are important, made sure we taught a lesson early on. So you kind of grew up, you kind of played hockey kind of through high school, college time frame.
Yeah. I'm not certain, you know, what makes somebody a good athlete, mm-hmm. period. My dad was a college basketball player. He played football. So he was sort of, I think he started kind of as a pre-med guy and eventually, you know, worked his way down because sports kept impacting his grades. Uh-huh. Somehow I had an affinity for the game. I think in most cases, I think this is, you know, until you asked it, I didn't think about it. It's, you end up with coaches matter a lot to you. Uh-huh. So you can have a coach that doesn't teach you much, but you like the game, or you can have a coach that doesn't teach you much and you can hate the game, mm-hmm. or you can have a coach that makes you love the game and teaches you a lot. And I was really fortunate at an early stage in, I'm going to say in quotation marks, mm-hmm. my hockey career that, you know, I had coaches that were innovators. The attitude I brought to the rink every day, because I started late because we didn't have the money. It took me 3 years of folding boxes and paper routes to afford a pair of skates. So I started, you know, in Canada, we'll start when we're four. I started when I was nine.
Oh my goodness.
And I sort of took to it quickly and had some great coaches along the way. And when people ask me about it, because they, you know, they'll see something that says, you know, I played professionally and so on. And I didn't. So I was very lucky. I was always the worst player on some very good teams. So when you play college hockey, you know, when you're a rookie, most of the times, you know, the bus leaves for a weekend of games on either a Thursday or a Friday. Mm-hmm. And as rookies, you load the bus, mm-hmm. or as players that aren't rostered for that weekend, you load the bus. So I was a pretty effective bus loader by the end of my college career. And then I had the chance to go off and play. Professionally, second division in Sweden. And that was a great experience and brought the same work ethic, every day to practice. I love the process of preparing. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have traded those experiences for the world.
Yeah. I like the thoughts of coaches matter and process for preparing, because I feel like that translates to what we do today. Like, and I think we can definitely get into that here in a little bit, but
look, we're at the headquarters today and for a while, decor changes all the time. For a while there was a series of posters here just to remind us, mm-hmm. that this is a business where you do sweat the small stuff. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about shortcuts, and Dan, you spent like a lifetime on projects.
Yep.
What happens if you take a shortcut in any process on a project, mm-hmm. a safety process, a quality process, a quantity survey of something in terms of where you're at, mm-hmm. not good things.
It costs you.
Yeah. And so it's in the same way that, you develop habits, commitment to process. So that journey, people either love that journey or they don't. Mm-hmm. You know, I've long since hung up the skates and that sort of thing, but I do these extreme bicycle rides, you know, mm-hmm. where I'll ride from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic, you know, 700-800 miles in 7 days. And I compete in bicycle events and stuff. And I always say, you know, the day that the competition takes place, I'm going to accept, you know, how I felt that day and, you know, what the results were, those sorts of things. But the real joy and the real satisfaction comes in the preparation and the dedication to sort of process and excellence. Every day you can say my preparation was excellent. That was an excellent workout or an excellent, you know, fill in the blank. That's where satisfaction, for me anyway, comes from.
I love the joy and the preparation. There's sometimes I can look back over my career where I felt like maybe I was a little stagnant, right? And maybe things weren't happening at the rate Daniel wanted them to happen, or, you know, it wasn't going per my plan. And somebody told me that one time, just experience the joy in the journey. Yep. And experiencing the joy every day, what you're doing, because you can get better at it. Unless you are the premier person of that could teach the entire company how to do this process, you can get better, right? Yeah. And there's not many people that are that people through those different processes. So I love that the joy comes in the preparation, and that's really what can make us great.
Well, Dan, just to stay on that point just briefly, then you think about it, right? So on a, you know, preparing a bicycle racing, it's a pretty solitary thing, except that it's not. You know, people like Richard Jaggers, Greg Hester, and I can't tell you the number of sort of world-solving bicycle rides that we've taken together. But that notion of that going through that process and having team members equally committed, equally taking sort of the joy from the process, that's ultimately what drives culture. It drives team culture on a hockey team. It drives team culture on a rowing team, a cycling team. But it drives culture at a company. And that's really what you see when you think about, you know, sort of our commitment to excellence every single day. I'm always really careful to say it's not perfection. It's a commitment to be excellent.
Yeah.
There's a big difference. Perfection is an impossible standard. It's an impossible expectation. But excellence is not an impossible standard, and it's not an impossible expectation.
Yeah, and excellence is attainable, right? You can be you can be super good at something and not be perfect, and it's excellent. And and like you said, it creates culture. It gives a little bit of competition, and you challenge yourself, challenge your team, just to be excellent.
When you think about it, you talked about sweeping, right? Joe Turner, at 16 years old. Joe Turner, for those of you who don't know, so, you know, runs billion-dollar jobs, getting towards the end of his career, obviously, but he started as sweeping at 16 years old at Hillsdale Fabricators. And every day, he just thought about, how can I be excellent today at whatever it is I'm doing? And eventually, he came to sort of have that expectation of himself that set a standard for others. And then, you know, as he grew in management ranks, then he would set that expectation not only of himself, but of others. So, kind of an interesting relationship between the difference between perfection and excellence.
Yeah, and it's a challenge to yourself every day to be excellent, to be better than you were the previous day.
Yeah, it's hard because you do, you know, I think about, you know, days on the bike and, you know, weeks where you're doing, you know, 250 or 300 miles. Sometimes you just don't feel like it.
Yeah. It's like, how far do we have to go today? Dang, 60? Are you serious?
Yeah. Or there's like really intricate little steps you have to do, and you just feel like riding the bike, you know? So it's tough. And I really relate, you know, I really relate to the, you know, the folks that work, you know, whether it's in our estimating world and the work acquisition process, or on the administration side, providing services. And obviously, you know, I use that expression a lot of time, the folks that are at the rock face doing what we do, you know, the challenge to be committed to excellence every single day when you've got, you know, possibly, you know, workers that aren't as committed as you are, or subcontractors, or you've got an owner that, you know, doesn't care or is unfair. And you just, you know, having the resilience to persevere through that, man, that's got to come from somewhere. And I think when you, and not to digress too much, but when you think about sort of the hiring process that we go through, and we talk about the qualities that we look for, you know, people that are smart, humble, team players. So you think about that notion of discipline, and that's the part that I'm talking about when I speak about that journey that you spoke about, that someone said to you, you know, embrace the journey. Not easy. But on your very best days, it feels great.
It does.
You know, and when you've got teammates around you, it feels even better.
Absolutely. A lot of good thoughts there. A lot to unpack. Those that are listening, those that are at the rock face, think about that. Think about your commitment to excellence on a daily basis. Greg, I want to talk a little bit about when you came to Alberici.
Yeah.
And you came to Alberici in 2001, and kind of what it was like for you to leave, and maybe talk a little bit about your early on work, you know, public service type stuff, onto when you got to Albarese and kind of how you felt and how things kind of started for you when you got here.
No worries. So remember we were talking about sweeping and folding pizza boxes and staying in school. I probably overlearned that lesson. I was in some version of university or college for almost 9 years. Now, for those of you listening, don't laugh. It wasn't 9 years full time, but you know, I ultimately ended up with a PhD in the most irrelevant, until the last 6 months, the most irrelevant subject area you could imagine. It was trade policy. Mm. But now with all the tariff talk, people actually care what my opinion is on some of those things. But with that, I ended up joining the Canadian Foreign Service. And so I was a foreign service officer. I was posted overseas and I worked on arms control negotiations, conventional arms control negotiations. And at some point, when you're a very junior diplomat in the summertime, whether you're in the U.S. Foreign Service or Canadian Foreign Service, you know, politicians, whether it be senators, congressmen, congressional delegations, they visit they visit overseas. And the Canadian Federal Minister of Science and Research visited Sweden, where I was posted to look at nuclear plants. And when he got back, he had a change of his chief of staff, and I got a call that asked me if I wanted to be chief of staff to the federal cabinet minister. That was a prime ministerial appointment, so you have to go through all sorts of security clearances and those sorts of things. So I was finished my public service career as a senior political appointee. When the governments are like no longer in power, you no longer have a job. Mm-hmm. And at the time in Canada, this would have been in the early 90s, there was a major move towards infrastructure privatization. So existing infrastructure like airports were being turned over to the private sector for P3s, you know, public-private partnerships, redevelopment. There were new infrastructure projects like toll roads being done. And those companies were looking for people that were conversant, both at a policy level, but also at a political level. They knew how to speak to politicians. They knew how to deal with policy and all the sort of the bureaucrats within the either in the various departments.
Sure.
So I fit the mold. Peter was working at a company that was doing infrastructure development.
Okay.
And the CEO of that company said to Peter, "Hey, don't you have a brother that's working in Ottawa doing something?" Mm-hmm. And I'd like to meet that guy. And that short story, that resulted in me joining and actually working for Peter for a number of years doing airport privatization. I mean, he and I spent years traveling around the world doing, you know, proposing on airports and that sort of thing. And at some point, those were always consortiums or joint ventures. A company which is now called Aecon, A-E-C-O-N as opposed to AECOM. So Aecon, big Canadian construction company, about the size of Albarese. They were going even further in that infrastructure world and offered me a role to, you know, kind of do that exclusively, which I did for 6 or 7 years. And publicly traded company was, I can now look back and say, boy, they were a good company, but they couldn't build like Albarese, Flintco. Mm-hmm. They weren't builders. Mm-hmm. They were phenomenal counters of dollars and pennies and cents and forecasting. Out of nowhere, publicly traded company, Hochtief out of Germany, a top 5 or 6 contractor in the world, made a hostile takeover bid. And I had by that time been put in charge of the industrial division at Aecon. Good division, but doing about $150 million a year, lots of self-perform work. So I really started in the industry as a trade contract, a specialty or a trade contractor.
Yeah, okay.
And when the takeover took place, there were a few of us plus an independent board member that actually put in a competing bid to kind of buy the company and so on. And
okay.
There was a lot of back and forth over the course of a year. And that we could never sort of get really serious dialogue with the Germans on that. And so at the end of the day, many of us had these 1 year commitments to stay. Mm-hmm. And, my 1 year commitment was up as well as some of my team members. And without a commitment to sort of stay in this business from the Germans, we decided to pull the parachute. Now we're jumping out of the plane. We don't have jobs. And, it was, you know, it was a few months, and you sort of think you're like, I'm 38 years old. I've been running a division successfully. So turnaround circumstance, my phone's going to be running off the hook. And month one, you're thinking, well, this is kind of nice to have a bit of a break. And then yeah. month two and month three. And then, you know, your wife is like, are you ever going to get a job? And ultimately, a headhunter, Chris Herman, mm-hmm. who's a long, long time Alberici person, had volunteered to go up to Canada mm-hmm. To run the Canadian operation. And he had been up there long enough and wanted to come back. And so they were looking for a president for Canada. And I went through, you know, a process of joining Alberici from there as their president of Canada in the summer of 2001.
So what was it like going from, or how big was Alberici, the operation you were running in 2001, compared to what you were doing at Aecon?
They were about the same size.
Okay.
Slightly different work, because Alberici in Canada, they had just purchased a company called Robertson Yates Company, RICO for short. And that company did a lot of buildings work, mm-hmm. libraries at universities, student centers, courthouses. But Alberici was starting to receive pressure from the automotive companies to Canadianize themselves a little bit more to do the auto work, which is really what their interest was in Canada. So they joined with Robertson Yates. And I became like a general contractor for the first time. It was, that transition was funny because we can be pretty hard on the specialties, and I had just come from being a specialty. Hey, that's not really fair. You know, we at the specialty level, and it's hard when you're putting an estimate together, you crew stuff up, you've got a certain amount of quantities, you sort of assume the space you'll have available to you at the rock face, mm-hmm. you know, up in a conveyor system, and then that space is not available to you, or the general tells you, you know, today the owner didn't release this space, so take all your job boxes, do this, do that, and go to some other part of a plant.
Right.
And the first thing you want to say is, okay, but like, we've been standing here with 12 guys and, you know, that's $1,500 and now we're moving and that's, you know, $3,000. First thing you want to do is like issue a ticket to say, okay, hey, we'll move wherever you want us to move.
But
sign this. It's $5,000. And it's a general, you know, your attitude is, hey, you know, unless you can show me you were really impacted, I'm not signing anything.
Exactly.
So I wrestled with that tension for a while.
What was your business philosophy kind of when you came over? You were probably thinking, this is what it's going to be like, and maybe what was it actually like, and how did your philosophy kind of grow the longer you stayed around?
There's really two parts to that. And the first part I got relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. The second part, I hope I get it today. The second part really came from, you know, somebody called John Alberici, and I'll tell you that story in a moment. But there was a guy at Aecon who ran the civil division, mm-hmm. the odd name, his name was Steve Perfect. And a civil engineer, really, really hardworking, bright guy. And I mean, I had come out of government, now I'm working at a construction company.
Big change. Yeah.
I have no idea. And I got a PhD in trade policy. I mean, I'm about as irrelevant to the industry as you can imagine. So I going down and meeting all the different divisional leaders at Aecon. And so this guy, Steve Perfect, says, Greg, if you remember one thing, remember this. He said that I was taught by somebody in the industry, this can be a pretty simple industry mm-hmm. if you remember these three things. Mm-hmm. Get the right work, do the work right, get paid for all the work you do. Not $1 more, not $1 less. And if you remember that, you'll be fine. Now, there's a whole bunch of layers to that. But so that was in my mind when I came to Alberici, you know, to really, every one of those things implies. So those are buckets for me. And at the end of the day, when you think about building your capability to execute in those three things, that's a combination of people mm-hmm. and your policies and procedures. So I just knew if we had phenomenal people at getting the work, phenomenal people at doing the work, phenomenal people at sort of getting paid or administering the work, we had a chance to be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that things would be as good as they could be. But I was also lacked a lot of experience in sort of where to go and get the work. And I mentioned to you all the brothers. Mm-hmm. So the youngest one, David, 1969, probably the smartest one. Mm-hmm. You know, speaks Japanese, MBA, Dartmouth guy, rode for Dartmouth, That's how we got, I mean, we couldn't afford to send them there, but, and they don't quite do athletic scholarships, but, you know, they arrange for people they want as rowers at Dartmouth to be able to afford to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working for a consulting firm called A.T. Kearney, and McKinsey and A.T. Kearney are the two largest management consulting companies in the world. And I said to him, I said, you know, I think I'm in way over my head here. I got this one, like, get the work, do the work. That part I got.
Yeah.
And so these two influences are about, like, what you do. And so David said, well, like, it's pretty easy. If you have a really effective commitment to operational excellence and a really group of folks that can execute properly, all you have to do is track global capital flows to see where money's going to be spent and then just get in front of the money. So I said, like, I understand the second part of your question, get in front of the money. What's a global capital flow? I said, that's easy. There's a bunch of really smart people in London and Wall Street and that sort of stuff. And it's amazing how true that is today. So Dan, if I were to say to you, you know, AI is around now, right? And I would ask you, when you think about all the private equity firms and the global banking system, where is it pouring its money into? AI infrastructure.
Yeah, I was about to say data centers. And yeah.
That's a global capital flow.
Sure.
So when David explained to me, it's like, oh, it's where money goes so that companies like borrow money or get private equity so they spend on things.
Mm-hmm.
You just get in front of where they're spending.
Mm-hmm.
So then I said, you know, I've got a PhD that kind of relates to economics and trade policy and so on. I think I might be able to sort of understand this and see down the road where sort of money was going to be spent by clients. And it taught me a lesson that said, you know, you never have to be 100% right on what the next market wave is going to be. And I always thought Peter, we were speaking last night over dinner, you know, Peter was really good at that, to sort of see a trend and a pattern. It wasn't formed yet, but it was going to be there. So you think about the sorts of things, you know, I had my own version of what I introduced about, you know, what Peter introduced. And now you look at this new management team.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. We're not waiting for 100% perfect answer on, you know, anything. We look at infrastructure programs and government spending, and we understand that, you know, at some point with deficit and taxes, that's going to be slowly reduced. So you prepare ahead of time to take this group of folks that, you know, do the work right, get the right work, do the work right, get paid for all the work. And so those two philosophies about, you know, get in front of the money and execute flawlessly, and that relationship to get the right work, do the work right, get paid for all the work, kind of to me guided me on what to do on a daily basis, like show up Monday, you know, finish on Friday, and then all the stuff we do on weekends. But that didn't help me get what Alberici was. So, you know, I'm at Alberici for 2 months. They're having this management retreat in Vermont, and I show up. The group had been working for about a year. They had read some books. One of them was from Arnie DeGeis, The Living Company, and the other one was, it was actually Built to Last, Jim Collins' first book. And I met John Alberici. I met him during the hiring process, but just briefly. And they're talking about these companies that are going to last for like 600 years. And
oh wow!
I'd come from a company that's like making sure we jam the last amount of money into the quarter to make sure that some 28-year-old analyst, you know, at Morgan Stanley thinks we're still worthy of being a construction company. And then, you know, John's talking about, you know, generational commitment to people and people excellence. And I didn't get it. You know, I remember coming back to my wife. She said, well, how was the retreat? And I said, I don't know. We talked about some books. You know, she's like, I didn't get it. And then, you know, over time, as you start to listen to John and what it means, he taught all of us how to be, and, you know, you can sort of see, it's funny, you know, if you speak to Greg Hesser, he speaks the same way. Every time we have this conversation, I go in the exact same pose. I hold my hands like this because John taught us to be stewards of the community that is the organization, the community that is Alberici. And we are stewards for a period of time. And so we take this community built on a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we steward it. We shepherd it over a period of time. And then we hand it off. And our job and what John teaches is to be good stewards of what that means. I'm not saying he doesn't care what we do, but management teams do different things. The market tells you you need to do different things. So he mm-hmm. doesn't care that we're doing, Boeing jobs or FedEx jobs or St. Jude's jobs. I mean, they matter to him in the moment in that it's our people and the clients that we work for are sacrosanct for John. But what he really wants is this stewardship
mm-hmm.
of what it means and how you be in the industry. And so that was my impression coming in. That became my business philosophy, that always a commitment to operational excellence,
mm-hmm.
working with our folks, our team, to understand where we believed, like all of our strategic planning meetings. We didn't write down the plan. To me, it changed like too quickly. Mm-hmm. But we had these, we called them brown bag lunch
sure.
groups. And we gathered in one of the rooms here. I call it the circle room. I forget what it's called, but it's got a bunch of microphones and chairs in a big circle. And we spoke about what was going on in people's markets. What were they seeing? People were all, we really big emphasis on going to conferences and listening and starting to process. Right. And then we would look for, within the group, we would look for people like to, volunteer to take on initiatives. And that got us into, eventually things like renewables, ethanol plants from auto plants and those sorts of things. And so we took a lot of guidance from those general rules.
Mm-hmm.
What wasn't a general rule for us was the fanatical commitment to identifying and screening talent, onboarding it, developing it, like inculcating the culture that we were. That was not like an 80-20 thing. That was 100% or you didn't get to stay here.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like the person, it was leadership didn't get to stay if they weren't totally 100% committed. Mm. It was fanatical. And for the first almost 15 years I was CEO,
mm-hmm.
I went to every single intern interview.
Really?
And our expectation, we have the intern summit going on right now in the building.
Yeah,
there
is, yeah.
And I said to myself, we should be picking interns that will become employees. Why would we ever waste that person's time, interview time? And, there was a lot of discussion around using the Alberisi screening tools and so on. And mm-hmm. it's like, well, yeah, of course they need to be able to pass the Alberisi stuff, because if they can't, then they can't work for us. And if they can't work for us, why would we want, and I don't mean this, it's not the intern's fault. It's our fanatical view on what we think, kind of makes us become great stewards of mm-hmm. the legacy that is Alberisi. So we were really, that was 100% compliance, or it just was not going to be a fun conversation. And I include myself in that. If I ever sort of backed away, that accountability on that gets set right from the very top.
But I think it's a great point though, when Alberisi acquired Flintco some 10 or 11 years ago, some of those hiring processes changed for us. And there were some growing pains and some groaning and all those different things. But the longer that we've been a part of the way that y'all onboard, the more successful we are in retention, the more successful we are in bringing in people that want to be stewards of the culture.
Right.
Right. And the company has become, not that it was a bad place to work for 10 or 12 years ago, it's just become better and better and better. And the quality of the folks that we bring in is better, which makes us all
better. It's, Dan, it's an interesting thing, right? If you, through all the testing we do, if it turns out that you're not like an ideal cultural fit for a Flintco Alberisi, it doesn't mean you're a bad person.
No.
Gosh, I mean, think about all the people we didn't hire. You must know a bunch of them,
uh-huh.
where they've ended up, and they're thriving.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic for them.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't have thrived. I think it's thrived.
Like that.
With us.
Right.
And
that's okay.
Yeah, it is okay. And I'm really proud of some of the people that, didn't kind of come through and where they've ended up. And in many cases, they've been, great joint venture partners.
Sure.
And we have fun working with them. It's just I was teasing, I think, last night when I said, you know, it's funny because the word culture has the first four letters are cult, you know, and sometimes I say, you know, we're fanatical, like in a cult-like way on making certain that we have like that cultural blend of, you know, smart, humble, disciplined team players. And when you think about the broader enterprise and all the pieces that make it up, and you think about the leadership of it and through all levels, that's the characteristic of a person that works within our enterprise, whether you be at Flintco, whether you be at, and if you're only that for a while, what will start to happen is you start to self-select out. Like it's all four, and over time it emerges. And if some of them start to fall off and it's just not for you, you self-select out. And I remember when we did one of our first chairman summits, one of the slides that Peter put up at Flintco, you know, they went from a very normal, when we bought them, very normal turnover rate in the industry, which is, you know, 10, 12%. I think at some points it gets to be a little bit higher than that. And yeah, we spliced a little bit because Peter put up a slide that sort of said, you know, Flintco turnover rate for employees that we would like to be with us was less than 1%.
Wow.
And Alberici's same criteria was less than 1.5%. So Flintco's retention using kind of the cultural matrix of what fit for Flintco was and has been phenomenal. And I don't know if you know the story, but when we acquired Flintco, there were 12 leaders of kind of in Flintco with the titles, lots of leadership within the organization, but 12. And they all did the CMA process before the purchase process. We do that for any company that we're looking at partnering with or acquiring. Maybe less so on the partnering side, but acquiring, you know, an acquisition is just a massive hiring process. On Friday, everybody at Flintco worked for Robin and the family, which by the way, is just like a wonderful family. And on Monday we hired 1200 people.
Yeah.
It's a giant hiring process. And so that notion of why would you hire anybody, like to go back to my intern comment, that couldn't ultimately, that wouldn't ultimately be a great fit. And my goodness, we were so impressed with the CMA processes for that group. You can't do it for like 200, 300, 400 people.
Sure.
I just remember thinking it's like an unbelievable group of managers and how powerful we could be. I remember saying to John, John, we've gone through the CMA and the senior Flintco leadership, they could take many of the jobs of like our key guys. And you didn't have to look at it like that. But what you said is I had 10 people to drive a billion some odd, you know, and all their teams and everything else. And now I have twice as many. I got 20. And what could happen? Well, look what happened. In not that long a period, about 11 years now, like 12 years, what happened? You took, you know, we were kind of doing 800 million and Flintco was 800 or a billion, you know, sort of move. But you sort of take about a billion and a half. And you look at the financial results and so on. This is an easy, like an easy measurement tool.
Sure.
And 12 years later, I don't know if you can tell me the numbers. I can tell, but yeah, you tell me the numbers. I mean, $4.5 billion.
Yeah. So I was going to say north of 4 billion. That's okay, unbelievable.
So we're 2.5 times on volume, 4 times on profit.
Sounds like it was a good acquisition.
And turnover rate. And turnover rate.
Yeah.
20% of the industry average.
Wow.
And I would say most days people are having fun. And what we've identified is it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, you came out of the Alberici system or the Flintco system, or for that matter, you know, whether it's WWPS or CAS, and obviously I include within the Alberici branded companies, Canada and ACL, you've just got this army of stewards that are stewarding, you know, the legacy of excellence.
Yeah, you got to love it. And that's really what I was going to ask you is what made Flintco attractive to you all? Like we were going to talk about the acquisition. You've done a good job kind of explaining that. But when that time period was coming around and you knew Flintco was available, what made you want to say this is the great group of folks that we want to jump on?
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a funny story on how Flintco got identified to us. It actually started with FMI calling us about an Egyptian contractor that wanted to buy Alberici, which we said no to, that was Orascom, who eventually bought White's. But while I was on the phone with FMI, I said, hey, you know, we hadn't spoken in a while. I want to tell you about some of the plans we have, but geographic expansion and why. And let me just do a quick segue as to what the background of why I wanted to have that conversation. We came through at Alberici through 2008
mm-hmm.
by luck. By luck. We happened to have landed a couple big jobs in 07.
Mm-hmm.
But every place where we were geographically located got hammered.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta, 3 bidders on water became 25 bidders on water.
Goodness.
St. Louis, you know, was under a lot of economic pressure with headquarters moving out. And Detroit was going to cease to exist. You have to remember the bailout under the Troubled Asset Recovery Program, the automotive bailout. So that's where all our offices were. That was the pond we fished in.
Right.
I was like, oh my goodness. Like operational excellence,
mm-hmm.
great stewards. We got through it, but I wasn't going to take a chance that we were going to be able to get through it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so we looked at the little economic model, get in front of the money,
right.
You know, capital flows.
Yeah, yeah.
The Southeast, more broadly than just Atlanta. South Central. The oil sector. Front Range. And Southwest. Geographically, we saw ourselves, you know, a picture that we had to be in those locations. We were trying to bid work in those locations during the downturn, but unless you had the subcontractor relationships and all that sort of stuff, you're not going to get
the numbers.
No. You're not getting exactly, Dan. You know the deal, right?
Yep.
So I identified Southeast, South Central, Front Range, and the FMI guy calls up and he says, "Greg, I found something for you."
Oh boy!
And I said, "This company is in." They started east and went in Memphis. I thought, oh, okay, not quite the Southeast, but mm-hmm. okay. They said they're in Oklahoma and Texas. I said, hey, that's South Central.
Mm-hmm.
And Oklahoma has a panhandle, which touches the front range.
Yeah.
So when I was explaining it to management, they're in the Front Range too, because they have this little skinny panhandle that I understand historically nobody wanted. So Oklahoma ended up with it.
Yeah, that's right.
And we all thought Arizona, but they were in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there was this California one that really didn't fit for us. And ultimately we didn't buy. But so there was a geographic spread. Was I in love with, you know, tall buildings and academic clients and healthcare and that sort of stuff? You know, from a margin perspective, we didn't know that work so well. We had a small
mm-hmm.
commercial building group here in St. Louis. And, but initially it was, we really liked their geography. Imagine if we could overlay the traditional Alberici work, the heavy, you know, heavy civil, heavy industrial.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw right away, my very first meeting, oh my goodness, these people at Flintco are so much more personable than we are. So they could probably sell better than us. Like, I mean, it wasn't when we were like curmudgeons, but they just were alive with like client focus more than we were. We were focused very much on, hey, we're going to come in, we're going to finish on time, on budget, but we just prefer you stay out of our way.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a very different approach, and it was realized, you know, I don't know if we could have changed that without Flintco, that whole sort of client orientation and what it meant. So that really made an impression right away. You can imagine meeting, you know, Dave Coleman, those sorts of things, and Kevin Moyes. And and then we realized, and you and I were just speaking before we got started, you know, that we saw probably the second thing was there's this commitment to operational excellence, which we really admired. And Dan, you were telling me the story that when you joined, they were just going through a process of kind of recommitment to operational excellence.
We were, yeah. It was the first better is what the mantra was.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, we've got to be good. We're growing, but we've got to be really good at what we were, you know, grew up doing. Good at the blocking and tackling, get the job done, get it done right. And, you know, it was the commitment to excellence, right? It wasn't perfection. It was like, hey, we're just going to be really good at what we do every day.
Right. So when you come back to think about get the right work
mm-hmm.
and what the, you know, if I were to say to you within that first, what did you call it again? The first better. First better.
Yeah.
And if I were to say, hey, define for me in the work acquisition process, what that meant, you know, the discipline of chasing the right jobs.
Yeah.
You can just imagine back in 05. So Flintco went through all of this. We had gone through almost at the same time
because mm-hmm.
we had really stubbed our toe, you know, in the early part of 2000s. And we talk about it in our Touchstone program, and at the Arrowhead Academy work and sure. all that stuff. So we stubbed our toe. And the way we got out of that was just this recommitment to operational excellence. And so we sent the due diligence team to start visiting Flintco projects probably 7 or 8 years into that recommitment to operational excellence from okay. Flintco. And our yeah. folks came back and said, unless there wasn't that the Flintco sign at the time to incorporate the Arrowhead, these look like Alberisi jobs.
Really?
Like they're super clean, super well organized. When you speak with the project managers, but also the project engineers and the people doing quant, it's just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you close your eyes, these are Alberisi jobs.
Oh, well, wow.
So that was, okay, we're really interested. And then, you know, it was really John that helped remind us that these are like big hiring exercises. John Alberisi reminded mm-hmm. us. And so we said, we'd never done this before. We said, well, why don't we give them the CMA? Why don't we write something in there? And I think we said, let's not use the word pass, like they have to pass it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's use the word, I think I came up with successfully complete. And we can leave it kind of general that way. So that's where, I mean, that's where it came from. And my goodness, right from day one, both companies have soared right from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the, I think back in, you know, 5 years in, you know, we were about $4 billion of backlog. And I remember Peter having done the math saying, because my brother Peter was running Flintco at the time, $1 billion of Flintco backlog, $1 billion of Alberisi backlog, and $2 billion of joint backlog.
Mm-hmm.
Could you really ask for anything? And if you speak to the Flintco folks, you know, did they lose their identity in any way?
No, not at all.
You know, it's in one sense, both companies at about the same time
mm-hmm.
came back to who they really were. Really fundamentally great executing companies. Flintco with a nicer personality
mm-hmm.
that we learned
Thank
from.
You. Thank you for that.
Yeah, that we learned from. We, you know, for Midwesterners, we were more grumbly than we really should have been. So anyway, that's kind of the Flintco story in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's a great story. I love to think that we've both soared since we've been there, because I can think back to very early on Flintco meetings. Charlie Strouser used to show like the pie of all the work that Flintco was doing yeah. and how many millions of dollars. And I mean, we were big time back then, you yeah. know, 2005, 6, 7, you know, the company I was working for had been bought by Flintco, and I was super excited seeing these big numbers, and now thinking about $4.5 billion. It's just, oh, it's incredible. And it's all done by, you know, good stewards of the company, of what John's provided, your leadership, also the communities they work in, which is what makes this a really awesome place to work.
Well, and the process, when you think about it, when we both go back to that time in our history, Flintco and Alberisi, our average project size, if I had to bet, was around $10 or $12 million.
Yeah.
Our average project size today, I think Lance Cage was telling me, is probably around 17, like combined. But if you were to look for how many billion-dollar plus jobs,
mm-hmm.
you know, Flintco was doing $1 billion, we were doing $1 billion. But how many billion-dollar jobs did we have? Like, we didn't have any.
No.
It was just a combination of little ones. So now you take still all of these, like, the bread and butter work that we do, and you overlay, it, for the last decade and a half, anywhere from 4 to 8
mm-hmm.
jobs at $1 billion or more. And there's a reason why we're good at those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about the planning and the discipline and that commitment to operational excellence. And that's really where, it's the combination, how many large projects and the phone calls that we get, you know, from the Kiewitz, the world, and those sorts of things about coming on to these very, very large projects. And so it's part of our DNA now.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I'll say, because I know we're watching our time a little bit, but the last thing I'll say is I was very nervous as we moved up the project scale. And Leroy Stromberg, who I loved working with, we were in one sense kind of opposites, but worked really well together. He was my chief operating officer for 15 years.
Sure.
And he was pushing to do bigger work. He had tremendous amount of confidence and the keenest eye for stuff that we should pursue that we could be successful at. It was uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, gee, you know, I don't like bridges. There's water, you know, and water's bad thing and that sort of stuff. And Leroy, we've never done a $1 billion job. And he said to me one day, he said, well, hang on a second. I think we have. Hear me out. He said, you know, the Chrysler job at Brampton or the Ford job. And he lists them and says, we were doing $10 million a week for 6 weeks. That's $60 million. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to mess up the math here. So if you did that for 52 weeks, that would be $520 million a year. Mm-hmm. And if the job lasted 3 years, it's like $1.5 billion. So we have done. And you know, at first I thought, I don't know about that.
Funny math, Leroy.
But then I thought about it. Mm-hmm. As I walked and visited those jobs, we had 2,000 and 3,000 people that we were organizing for 6 straight weeks, 24 hours a day. And we really cut our teeth on those automotive shutdowns. And that's where the legacy of being able to do, I mean, I think we peaked on the EV battery job, the largest EV battery plant in North America that mm-hmm. the Canadian team is working on at Windsor, now really come to completion. I think the number was we were doing 5 million a day for about 90 straight days.
Wow.
Think about that, 5 million a day. And
that's unbelievable.
And we don't sit there and say, oh my gosh, we're overwhelmed by this. What we do is say, we better be good today.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to our commitment to excellence. This is a day we need to be excellent. We're doing $5 million today. You think about how many small businesses in America don't do $5 million in a year. We were doing it every day for 90 straight days.
That's unbelievable. It's a great segue to talk about projects. And I wanted to ask you, if you could think about a favorite project, and we talked about it a little bit last night, what makes a favorite project. So let's talk about that for a few minutes. On if I was going to ask you, Greg, tell me what your favorite project is. Now give me the answer.
Yeah, you know, we did talk about it, and it's funny. I'm like, I don't want to characterize all ex-athletes, but ex-athletes are superstitious. You know, I put the right shin pad on first. I tied the left skate first. You know, all those sorts of things, and so I don't like to speak about. I'm tremendously proud of what we do. And, you know, so talking about projects, that's like for my wife, my kids, I say, we did that. We did that. We did that.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's sort of one of those funny things, tremendous amount of pride. And I know that when we're trying to recruit somebody, you point out the projects that you did and everything else. I always think about projects in terms of the project teams.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like the funnest projects, and they don't necessarily have to be fun, but there's pictures that come to mind when I think about like the canopy project for the Miami Dolphins Stadium
mm-hmm.
or the Platte River West treatment plant that we did. And, you know, I can see the stadium, which was a bad job for us in the end, but I can see the stadium and it sort of passes through my mind. But the things I remember most was someone like a Mike Rota telling me that, you know, he's been working, you know, 17 straight days, but he's finally getting to take a bike ride.
Mm-hmm.
And he took a bike ride somewhere in Florida, which I was, you know, South Florida, which I was surprised that he did and still showed up.
Yeah.
You know, but Craig Gonet, who was our quality guy in there,
mm-hmm.
with all the pretty tough things that were going on in that project, he did a barbecue. Mm. He would barbecue these pork steaks that mm-hmm. was a very kind of Missouri thing. He'd barbecue these pork steaks and with just hell flying.
Yeah.
You know, so it's things like that that I remember. I remember Wilbur and Mike Burke and those guys just like pulling rabbits out of hats every single day to deal with incomplete drawings, poor drawings and all that. And so that's sort of one from later years. One of the very early ones was a seminal project. We were just getting back on our feet. We were bidding a job at water treatment plant at Platte River, just outside of Omaha. Joe Turner, Ron Weese, myself, and a bunch of guys worked really, really hard on the estimate. And we won.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe, who was the market leader for water wastewater, said, Greg, this project is so important for the company. I'm going to step away from my market leader role and I'm going to go and do the job. And so Joe became our first ever vice president of construction. And I remember visiting that job and being struck by two things.
Mm-hmm.
The setting sun.
Oh, yeah.
And seeing light plants still all around the site and asking Joe, I was like, you know, who are the guys there? And said, well, that you know, we've got a big pour coming tomorrow and, you know, that's the rebar crew doing this or doing that. And there was just this tone that Joe and the team had set on that job. And look, and a lot of I hate when I say to pick on Joe, because it means I'm not listing hundreds of others.
Sure.
But Joe always, you know, would do something social. You know, you talk about that stewarding the community.
Yeah.
And on that job, there was a brand new golf course that had opened up that got rated as the best public course in America for a couple years in a row. It was 5 miles from the job. And we had Tuesday night golf league. And I will admit to arranging my visits around availability to play in the Tuesday night golf league. I was not particularly gifted golfer, but I love to get out with the team. And so Joe, you know, there was winter bowling leagues, those sorts of things. So when I think about projects, I think about everybody that worked on them, the contributions that they made, the ideas that they came up with, Philip Lee and the team that led the BJC work here. Mm-hmm. On the Flint Coast side, I still think it's at the top of my list, my very first visit to St. Jude's. Uh-huh. And they're explaining like just their passionate commitment to the mission of St. Jude's. That's one of those things we just learned so much from Flint Co. Is this, it's a zippering of the client that's more than a technical zippering that has to do with like on schedule, on budget, quality's fine, safety's fine. And it's like, they're telling me the story, how they committed to donate blood to like a certain amount of blood because it was our blood plasma
yeah.
to St. Jude's because they said that's more important to money than us. And I said, well, what do you mean? Well, every Friday we're on a rotation because we can only go, I think it was every 6 weeks.
Oh my goodness.
Everybody. And then we got all the subcontractors that, like, you don't want to work for us. You got, and
yeah. I
thought, these guys are literally giving blood. You just think about the symbolism of that. And what it means for the patients and the organization that is St. Jude's. And so it's those things, those project teams and the lengths that they'll go to support that are just really, really meaningful to me. And those are the stories as I get older and older that I remember most. I mean, I hate to say it, one assembly plant, trim chassis, final line, they start to all bleed together. I love cars and, you know,
sure.
the power plants, the waste treatment plant, all that stuff. It's all fun to see. But at the end of the day,
it's the people, right?
It's the people, because those things all start to bleed together over time. But you'll remember stories about the people and the extra effort, the extraordinary effort that they went to advance the culture of the company.
Yeah, I love thinking about that. When I think about my favorite job, I think about the folks I worked with.
Yeah,
yeah, we just happened to be working on a project for the University of Texas, and we just happened to be hugely successful, but it was the folks that were working together that were committed to that excellence that really delivered a great project. And we all walked away from there super happy. The owner was happy with us. We finished early. We gave money back. And just, I mean, I could remember details about it, but I could tell you more stories about what the guys did and some of the pranks we played on each other, the bandit that we called it, you know, that would sneak in and you'd turn the air conditioner on your office and all these three-hole punch, you know, things would fall out of the ceiling. You know, I've been on vacation. I still, you know, 2 years later, I was dumping these out of my keyboard. But it was, we had a great time working together, and it was those folks that made it memorable.
And think about that, Dan. Do you, you know, the level of caring.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you may have worked with some of those folks again. You may not have. They may be on other projects. But there's a deep caring that develops.
Mm-hmm.
That you care about them. You know, you think about the ones that you've picked up the phone and called, you know, when, you know, maybe their kid got into college or our younger one might have, you know, gotten married or whatever the circle, or they just got a really cool promotion.
Mm-hmm.
It hits you in a way
yeah.
that you care about.
It does. Absolutely.
You know, and that's really one of the special things about Alberici is the reason why it hits you that way is because that's the type of people we recruit.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. As we're closing, getting towards the end, I wanted to ask you a little bit about looking back over your last 24 years here. What are some big misses? Maybe if we could talk about a miss, or maybe talk about you know, big wins as you were looking for where the money was going to be.
I'll laugh at some of these. It's almost like, how could we have gotten it this wrong? The two misses, like, look, there's jobs that we bid, mm-hmm. That we missed something and we were just like way out in left field dollar-wise. There were jobs we underbid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were jobs we underbid where we looked at something and we thought, you have to watch confidence. Confidence is a very kind of dual-edged sword.
Sure.
You know, I remember the, yeah, you just have to, I won't go into all that, but it was just, you looked at something and you thought it was simpler than it was. And you didn't ask the right questions. The art of asking questions is really everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody can master the art of answering, and people can say anything, it's an answer, but asking deep penetrating questions. And look, I missed lots of times on bids. I would miss things, but for me, not being from the industry, I would make people walk me through. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when the guy comes up the material man lift, what does he do next? And I would just visualize all of it. Okay.
Sure.
And they're carrying number 9 rebar all day long on this, you know, silo. Okay. And they're doing it for how many days? You know, just visually walk me through it. So lots of those sorts of misses. But in terms of big market misses,
mm-hmm.
we were there was the talk about renewables.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were all in on coal.
Sure.
Okay? We were doing coal everywhere. We were getting coal. We were doing coal seam mining work where we were pulling coal out of the ground and building conveyors and all, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we were getting the coal. We were building hoppers for the coal to come into, and then we were building power plants to burn the coal, and then we were putting all the environmental systems on to clean the emissions.
So sure.
All in on coal. We have interns like we have now, and we asked a bunch of interns to sort of say, hey, we're, I don't know, 2005 or six, you know, on renewables. We hear, you know, geothermal, hydro, wind, solar, and the big guys sitting around, you know, all of us that have like a few stripes on our arms, you know, the CEO and Leroy, and we're sitting there and the interns are making this presentation that this is the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going through why there's going to be an explode. This is 05.
Okay.
Why there's, you know, why solar and wind are going to explode. Geothermal, they were less certain about, and they were less certain about hydro because of permitting and you know, minnows and things that can't be touched and damaged. So we sit and we listen to this and thank you very much. We ask a bunch of questions and I was part of the conversation. So I'm not putting this off in anybody, but one of the guys said, you know, that solar stuff's not really for us, like concrete. Like we're specialists at digging holes and pouring big blocks of concrete in and deep heavy rebar. And then we attach steel to that concrete and then, yeah, we'll put a conveyor or whatever on it. Like a solar field's like a almost like a patio stone, and you put some things on it, and that's electrician's work.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do solar. That's one thing. That's not going to go anywhere. We're not going to pursue it. And then wind, we had some other reason for not. Wind wasn't going to go anywhere. But hydro, that's more our stuff. That's big, heavy machinery and everything else. That was a bit of a huge miss. We did one hydro job. We lost money on it. I don't think there's been a hydro job to bid. We bid one recently, but I mean, there was a hydro job once every 2 or 3 years. Solar took off, wind took off. So that was a pretty big market call miss.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, you know, data centers have been around for about 12 years in terms of a big mark, kind of mission critical.
Sure.
Peter got it. Peter mm-hmm. got it certainly better than I did. I didn't get it. And so it was like, well, what kind of contract you got to sign and what's the fee you're going to get? And how many of these things you're really going to need?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no. My call was, data center's not for us.
Mm-hmm.
Margins are too low. Contract was not friendly. And can't imagine there's going to be that many of them.
Right.
Another brilliant call by the leader, you know, sort of thing. And so we're doing what we can to make our way back into some of those, but those were misses.
Sure. What about big wins?
My goodness, I go back to the Platte River job because I was at a time where cash was really, really tight.
Mm-hmm.
And the team, especially the estimating group, taught me the fine art of front-end loading lump sum projects. So mm-hmm. 12 months in, we had, you know, 25 out of $29 million of profit for a job that was going to go 3 years. So that was a lot of cash flowing through the system.
Yeah.
Really helped out at the time. So that was very noteworthy. But my goodness, some of the big hurricane work, recovery work it was meaningful in a social sense
mm-hmm.
after Katrina. You know, it's not always the billion-dollar jobs. I mean, those are impressive. But, you know, the first masonry job we won after buying a masonry contractor, you know, to see what Midwest Foundation, which was our reentry into marine work, mm-hmm. and then look at the marine work that we do now. I mean, I'm just so proud of the opportunities that jobs like that gave to young people to go run their own business.
Yeah.
I mean, we basically bought those business because we had a group of folks. We said, these people seem like they could actually run a business. They could be they could become a senior project manager, project director, but they might have more fun mm-hmm. Running a business. So mm-hmm. I think about it, you know, kind of in that sense of it, like almost too many to mention, but it comes really back to the people are the ones that are most noteworthy to me.
Absolutely. Well, Greg, it's been just my distinct pleasure to have you on today. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate talking about the commitment to excellence. So if you're listening and you are part of the enterprise, or even if you're not part of the enterprise, like there's a commitment every day to be excellent, right? And I think that's a calling for anybody listening, or definitely everybody as a part of our enterprise. And remember that there is a journey, right? And sometimes the journey doesn't go the way you want it to, but in that journey, find the joy on the daily basis. Find the joy being excellent in what you're called to do in that time, in that moment, for your project to be successful. And sweat the small stuff. You said that very early on.
There was a poster that would remind us every day.
Well, and just make sure that you're doing the steps. You're following the steps. 1, 2, 3. Don't take the shortcuts. Sweat the small stuff and be excellent. So, Greg, it's been awesome. Thanks again for coming in. And we hope to have you on again sometime.
Yeah, real pleasure, Dan. Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Appreciate it.